Les colloques du Collège de France.
Welcome back, or welcome for those who came for the afternoon session. So it was not planned that I would be the chairman again. I wanted to pass this task to Pierre-Louis, but when he says no, he's one of the few persons where I take no for an answer. So I will chair for three speakers for this session. So the first speaker of this afternoon session is Dave Levermore, a dear old friend of Claude, Francois, and also myself, who hosted me in Tucson, Arizona. I will never forget for my longest stays there. And so Dave will give a talk. So we had a lot of talks on Euler Navier-Stokes, so now you will learn how to go beyond Navier-Stokes. Thank you, Dave.
All right, well, it's a great pleasure to be part of this celebration of everything Claude's meant to the entire community, and so let's begin. So where's my, here it is, okay, advance, no, there it goes. So we met, and I don't know if I saw you at a lecture earlier, but we didn't really meet, but we met here. There was a AMS-IM summer seminar called Nonlinear Systems of Partial Differential Equations. This had been organized by Basil Nikolenko, Daryl Holm, and Mac Hyman. And I think it was through Basil that you were invited. And in his usual generous self, he dragged along a whole bunch of remarkable group of young French mathematicians, some of whom are in the room. If you were there, raise your hand. One, two, three, yeah, okay. And so we were treated to 2 weeks of lectures, spectacular lectures. Some were from here, Luc Tartar, I particularly remember. Claude, I particularly remember. And some, I think, were the first time the French people were meeting Louis Nuremberg and Martin Krusko and a whole bunch of other people. So it was a fun meeting. I was very popular because I was already working at Lawrence Livermore Lab, and they allowed me to rent a car. And as the College of Santa Fe was sort of outside the main part of Santa Fe by quite a bit, I was able to drive people to the good restaurants in Santa Fe, of which there were many. And so very often I was having lunch and dinner with Claude at the good restaurants in Santa Fe. There's stories about that that can wait until this evening. But what impressed me about Claude at the meeting was his questions. And for me at least, and I think for many others, his questions were a lens that focused on mathematical opportunities. And this is a fantastic skill to have, not only as a researcher, but as a mentor to younger people. So I was asked by the Kaiser in particular to talk about the BGL program, and so I have a few slides on that. So it began because of this first meeting. For whatever reason, Claude thought it was worthwhile inviting me to come for a summer in Paris, a month. Fortunately, I had also an invitation from École Normale Physics to come for a month, and so I got to spend 2 months in Paris. And the starting of the collaboration with Francois and Claude was just one of those remarkable instances. And in fact, the fact we're here now is really important because we came for two lectures, one by Ron de Pernin and one by Louis Nuremberg, who were in the big lecture hall, not the small little guy. And afterwards, we went to a cafe just across the street here. And we sat down, and those of us who knew Ron de Pernin knew very well that he would not have cared about the Boltzmann equation unless he thought it was a route to compressible Euler. This was his whole reason for existence, mathematically. And we had all read the paper enough, the de Pernin-Lyons paper enough to know that there was a formal obstruction to doing the compressible Euler limit. And so Ron must have been disappointed about that. But then Claude, in his usual fashion, asked the question if there was some other fluid dynamic limit that might be obtained. Now, I didn't think of it on the spot. I had been working in cellular automata, and we were doing simulations of incompressible Navier-Stokes. And so I knew what the scaling was. In fact, I'd kind of known it since graduate school. And so I showed it to them on napkins in the cafe. Well, those of you that know the two might guess that they were first very skeptical, having been experts in kinetic theory and having never seen this before. But I could see as we went through about three or four napkins that Claude was interested. So at some point he gets up and let's go back to the Ecole Normale. We march back and there's the classroom at the CMA and you redid the calculation. Do you remember that? You're on the board. And more or less he reproduced it exactly. And then there was a point where there's a little trick in the calculation and I showed him the trick and that's all he needed. He had it. He went home happy. And the next morning, I got to go to the next morning. Joop. Come on. Whoops, went too fast. Yeah, Claude showed us how to reformulate the Hilbert series expansion in terms of moments. And why that was interesting is for all the reasons you heard in Francois' talk, if you were here earlier today, we understood that in the average, by doing things in moments, you had a chance of working weak solutions. And so it was pretty evident that the idea of going from de Pernod-Lyon's theory to Leray theory, or some version of it at least, was an opportunity to be investigated. However, there were many obstructions to this, evident right from day one. And Claude was really leading the way here, I would say. Those who know Francois know he was probably the most skeptical at this point, but that was good. The skepticism was necessary because we had to understand what the opportunities were realistically. So, for example, a very simple one is de Pernod-Lyon's is just a little better than an L1 theory and Leray is L2. And how do you get from L1 to L2 estimates? And within a few days, we understood you don't, except in the limit. You can actually recover L2 in the limit, but not before. And there were little ahas like that, that after a while, we had some preliminary results. We knew the program wasn't complete. So the first is a crass note, and then this was our formal framework, and this was where we were giving the rigorous steps of what we had so far. So, whoops, went too far. Oh no. Yeah. Anyway, the point of that story was that it was Claude that provided the spark for that collaboration. And in a similar fashion, he has provided a spark to many programs that people have started, many in this room. And for this, we're happy to join the celebration. Happy birthday, Claude. And I think me personally, but I think many other people in the room would join in saying merci. Okay, so on the orders from the Kaiser, here it is. This first paper with rigorous steps all laid out left five important gaps. And we were very clear in the paper to say we were short of the program and that these were five opportunities. So, first, we assumed local momentum conservation. This does not hold, at least formally, as one would expect in the de Pernod-Lyon setting. We used a discrete time setting because at the time we didn't know how to handle the time regularity of the acoustic waves. That would fall into place later. The heat equation wasn't even treated because the flux of the heat equation involved cubic moments and we had no control of cubic moments, or so we thought. We really made some unnatural assumptions about the collision operator. If you look at that, it was just what was needed to make the arguments go through. There was little physical basis for them and they excluded certain important cases. In fact, it was hard to verify they included any important cases, but they did. And finally, there was a weak compactness assumption that we made to treat nonlinear terms. And it took 20 years, but they were all overcome. So it comes in steps. So the three of us produced a paper in which we went for the Stokes Fourier limits. So this is linearized equation, system of equations, and the acoustics in a very restrictive setting. And why it was restrictive, because at the time we were controlling fluxes with the more or less with the entropy rather than the entropy dissipation. A very important step was due to Pierre Louis and Nader Masmoudi. It grew out of Nader's, if I'm correct, Nader's dissertation work, is that right? Or toward his habilitation, maybe. But what they had done earlier was pass to the limit from compressible Navier-Stokes to incompressible. And that was actually a very important paper, I should say, Pierre-Louis, because I grew up in the shadow of Andy Mida, and of course Andy and Sergio Kleinemann had done it, but they'd done it for the absolutely easiest of cases, but went around saying the problem was solved. And this, of course, discouraged many young people from going and doing what was, in fact, a harder problem in the same direction. And so the fact you guys did that sort of blew that, you know, advanced the field. This was good. And we, more importantly, the ideas that they used to control their time regularity were key to now controlling the time regularity for Boltzmann too. And Francois, by the way, these dates are the dates of the first publication. The actual aha moments happened usually 3 years before. And in particular, Francois was visiting me in Tucson about the time of the wedding, my wedding to Lucy over there. And we finally understood clearly how to use the entropy dissipation estimate to control the flux terms. And this was a big advance, because it really meant the heat equation was easy, the everything was better. The acoustics were easy, so on and so forth. So everything was now had fallen into place except that last assumption. And here Laura enters the scene. And I met Laura as a student. Francois brought me down to her office, or we went somewhere, I forget. She's asking me all these questions, and it's like, wow, okay. Again, good questions. And she went ahead and treated the BGK model. And embedded in the BGK, she proved the first one to prove sort of incompressible Navier-Stokes, fully nonlinear, but from the BGK model. And embedded in her proof, which was dense, was clearly what became part of the L1 velocity averaging. Okay, come on, there we go. And it was very helpful when, in a short note, Laura and Francois extracted that and presented it to the community in this beautiful note, 6 pages, I think, as a general tool that could be applied and has been applied elsewhere. They went on to take the BGK ideas and apply it to at least 4 bounded collision kernels, which is a very restricted set. Bounded collision kernels, the Navier-Stokes limit. I should say Fourier too, I guess. You had Fourier in that? I forget. Anyway, and then they went on and did it for hard spheres, which is a slightly harder problem because it's hard spheres. And then Nader Masmoudi and I, extended the class of collision kernels to include both soft and hard potentials. So I'll say a word about this. The key thing was, again, another idea of Laura that gets much less visibility. She had as clever a bootstrapped estimate as I've ever seen for getting information out of the dissipation estimate of the Boltzmann entropy. And she had a long name for it, which I think Nader and I used in the paper, But people should pay attention to that, because that is a real tour de force, and we totally borrowed it from lore. But the way it was in their earlier papers didn't apply to soft. So we needed two tricks. One was due kind of to Nader, and the other came from my former student, Wei Ran Sun, who, well, I gave her the problem, but there was sort of this mythology among the Boltzmann world that you had to do hard potentials because you needed a spectral gap. And I always felt this was nonsense. Partly, I was D'Epernay-Jones didn't need a spectral gap. And what Wei Ran did in her, as part of her dissertation actually, was show that the soft potentials had a kind, they didn't have a spectral gap, but they had a Fredholm alternative, and that's what you needed. Okay. So we're going along. At this point, we're pretty happy, at least with incompressible Navier-Stokes. Now, in a periodic box. But unless you have a huge lab, you're never going to fit a periodic box in it. And so what about boundary conditions? Well, here, Stefan Mischler added to the D'Epernay-Jones theory a Maxwell accommodation condition. Now, for those of you that know Maxwell accommodation, that's better than nothing. But it's actually not a totally physical set of boundary conditions. It actually doesn't have enough degrees of freedom to actually match the macroscopic world. And the argument that Stefan had used really used the structure of the Maxwell accommodation boundary condition. So this is a door that can be opened if someone's clever enough to figure out how to do more general boundary conditions within the D'Epernay-Jones framework or some other framework. All right. And then, but using that, Nader and Lohr rapidly did the Stokes Fourier limit, so no nonlinearities there, it's linear. And they get no slip boundary conditions, because that's what things are to leading order. And Ning and Nader and I, a little bit later, did the acoustic limit. And the beauty of the acoustic limit is the only boundary condition you get in the limit is the normal velocity zero. And all the tangential stuff goes away. And you can prove that rigorously in the limit. So it's very nice to see that come out without asymptotics. I mean, it's sort of... Now, one of the problems with these is both of these are short from what is formally expected because we have to work hard to get rid of the conservation defects in D'Epernay-Jones. So if there's an improvement in the theory of the Boltzmann, presumably these could be made more optimal. The other thing that's missing in the first is we know from formal asymptotics and from numerical experiments and simulation that the Navier boundary condition is actually the right boundary condition for Navier-Stokes. And that has not been rigorously established in this setting. Okay. Okay, lately there's been, and in our meeting, there's been a lot of talk about Hilbert's sixth problem. And what we just talked about, this beautiful little collaboration with Francois and Claude, was a tiny part of the larger sixth problem. But in reading certain manuscripts, articles, and whatever, I realized a lot of people use the term sixth problem, expecting to get some attention, but don't even know what it is. So first, superficially, what it is. Well, what was going on when Hilbert made this was a revolution in physics. So up until 1850, the theory of heat was all about something called caloric. Caloric was, of course, something postulated by Lavoisier and Laplace in the 1780. Trouble is that measuring heat is difficult, and so they developed the measurements called calorimeters, which had huge error bars back in the early day, and it made them very hard to get accurate measurements. Things got much better in the early 1800s, But out of this whole thinking eventually led to an understanding of the law of conservation of energy. Now, many mathematicians talk about, oh, we show energy is conserved. That was known to Leibniz and Newton. No. Because you are thinking of energy as merely an integral. And that's not the way the physicists were thinking about it, right? They're thinking about the relationship between kinetic energy, potential energy, together mechanical energy. That was understood by Newton and Leibniz. But the relation to thermal energy, and even the relation to work, surprisingly, was not understood clearly. So what's the formula for kinetic energy? One particle, 1/2 mv². If you go back and look at Leibniz and all those early people, they were doing mv². Who put the 1/2 in front of the mv². Who? Louder? Well, I don't know. You tell me. It was Coriolis. Now, Coriolis, so the word energy had been invented by Thomas Young around 1802. And he invented it because, you know, in the 1700s, you began getting this, people stopped writing in Latin and they were writing in their native languages, so French, German, whatever. And what had been a very uniform vocabulary for energy, vis viva, was now a zoo of terms that didn't sound anything like each other. So Thomas Young proposed, he created this word out of some Greek root or something, energy. And it took several decades for it to fully catch on, but it did, because it's now a word that's almost the same in all languages. Okay. So why did the 1/2 go there? So that the derivative of the kinetic energy corresponds to mechanical work. And you understand mechanical work as a conservation concept goes back to the ancients. This is from simple machines, levers, even hydrology later, right? There was notion of conservation of work. And now all of a sudden it's tied to the mechanical stuff and then ultimately the thermal energy. Okay, now this realization actually suggested to some that thermal energy might actually be kinetic energy of tiny molecules that compose matter. And in fact, this had been suggested quite early by Daniel Bernoulli in the famous appendix, I think it's chapter 11, of Hydrodynamica, but was widely dismissed at the time. And so it comes up again in the 1850s, and was dubbed at that point, I think it was in something like, sometime in the 50s, the kinetic theory of heat. Come on, there we go. All right, well, it was highly controversial. After all, we had this existing theory of heat, Kalorek, and all of a sudden the people were talking about these things you could not see and could not measure, and that they were responsible for the heat. The two sides were called the atomists and the energists. The energists believed in energy, the new concept, as a sort of object. Anyway, from a modern perspective, you say, well, isn't it obvious? You know, how could they say? Well, let me point out some obvious things that were wrong with the atomists' argument at the time. So the first one is specific heat capacities. This goes back to Clausius's 1875 paper, in which he proposes that the difference in heat capacity seen in measurements had something to do with the size of the molecules. In other words, how complex they were, how many atoms and whatever that they might have. What their structure was, they weren't entirely sure. And so he postulates this thing, you know, a diatomic molecule will have a different heat capacity than monatomic or triatomic. And the problem was that the predictions for monatomic were, there were no known such molecules. Nothing was monatomic. Everything was known from calorimetry to be polyatomic. All right? And in fact, this was largely the case. The first monatomic molecule that was known was mercury vapor. And that was in 1776, something like that. So well after this work was being done. Okay. So problem number one, the prediction for monatomic molecules had no representatives. Not only that, the predictions for other molecules were kind of all over the place, the error bars. They didn't really have a convincing theory that was predicting the right heat capacities. Clausius, in his first paper, was criticized because his model had these polyatomic molecules whizzing inside a container, and the only interactions were collisions with the wall. And someone made the observation that if someone walks into a room smoking a cigar, you don't smell the smoke right away. It takes time for it to fuse. And Clausius went home and thought about that, and he came up with the concept of mean free path. But to do that, he had to postulate the way the things interact. And he did the simplest thing possible. He said these molecules, even though they're not points, they're going to interact as if they were hard spheres. A simple model to come up with the concept of mean free path. Okay. This was then taken up by Maxwell so Maxwell enters the fray because of this paper of Clausius, and Maxwell understands that with the concept of mean free path, that he can actually make a prediction from the kinetic theory of what the viscosity of a gas should be like. And he derived the Maxwellian. This came out in 1860. And in the same paper, he showed that the viscosity has to go like temperature to the 1/2 and be independent of the density. Now, he thought this was for sure wrong, and that therefore experiments would show that this to be wrong and would kill the kinetic theory. And you see this in his private letters to Kelvin and so forth and so forth. So he doesn't find any convincing experiments, so he does them, actually with the help of his wife, who apparently was very good in the lab. And much to Maxwell's surprise, the viscosity was independent of the density. But it wasn't temperature to the 1/2. It was closer in his eyes to first power of temperature. And that did two things in Maxwell's mind. Number one, he now believed Clausius in the kinetic theory. And number two, he knew that the hard sphere model for molecules was wrong. This was understood in 1865. And he derives the Boltzmann equation, but he writes it down in such a way that kills the singularities that you get from the far field interactions. This was it's a weak form we know now, but no mathematician was thinking of weak form back then. And he was just way ahead of his time in this regard. Okay, Maxwell. And he had to do that because he knew things weren't hard spheres. And he was exploring 1/r, inverse power law interactions, and he called them molecular potentials because these weren't point particles interacting, these were molecules interacting. And why did he do a central force? Because that was the thing he knew how to integrate. Did anyone here solve a 3 or 4 body problem recently? Line up for your Fields medal if you have. All right. The next thing is something Claude loves, reversible to irreversible. People often say that Loschmidt was the first one to point that out. That's nonsense. Maxwell invents his demon, the famous Maxwell demon, exactly because he went from Boltzmann to Navier-Stokes, which breaks the microscopic reversible symmetry. And he invents the demon first in letters to Kelvin and his buddies. Kelvin's the one who names it the demon. And it appears in a popular magazine already in around 1870, before Boltzmann even publishes on this, at least. Okay. So Boltzmann did publish, of course, and what he added to it was very important, the H theorem. And the fact he wrote things not in the precise way of Maxwell, but in a somewhat looser way, was a great asset to him discovering the H theorem, which shows we have to be careful when we think about rigor or criticize non-rigor. By the way, I should add in that regard that there's many people who say that these old people didn't understand clearly the difference between atoms, molecules, and particles. And people who make that criticism didn't read these people carefully. They understood completely. They understood completely. But it was the nature of this approximation, two polyatomic molecules, and because we can only model the interaction as if they were central force, whatever, people therefore were confused that they really meant atoms here. No. They understood completely. They were modeling polyatomic molecules. So that's Lord Kelvin Thompson. He already writes a paper addressing this, Loschmidt's criticism. Loschmidt's a very interesting guy. He's on the side of Boltzmann. And he's just publicly airing this in order to try and bat down, Boltzmann responds, to bat down the discussion, the criticisms about reversible to irreversible. All right, time averages versus ensemble averages. This paper of Clausius, which you see here, is incredibly important. I list it twice, it's so important, because it's up there in the molecular interactions as well. Clausius, once, 5 minutes? Well, I'm going to go real fast now, but this one's a good one. This paper of Clausius is where he computes the pressure of a gas of molecules that interact by central force interactions, so exactly Maxwell's model. And he does it in terms of a time average. This is where he invents the Virial theorem that we all learn in mechanics and stuff like that. This paper had three immediate descendants. One of them I mentioned here. Boltzmann introduces the ensemble average in statistical mechanics to make sense of this. And Maxwell brings this paper to the attention of van der Waals, who uses the intuition in it to invent the van der Waals equation of state and discover phase transitions and win a Nobel Prize in physics. That's pretty good. Clausius, since all of his particles in the gas could be different masses, different objects, he understood right away that the ideal gas law had a universal constant in it, at least according to the theory. So he had his student, Horstmann, collect all the data that people had done on gas laws and find, how many learned in kindergarten, you know, PV equals NRT, right? N number of, well, R is universal, the way we learned that. And N, they didn't have any idea how to measure. So they were doing the mass of the gas. So the constant was always depending on the gas. Until you change the M for mass to N for moles. So Horstmann did that to the best of his ability, given the uncertainties they had about Avogadro's number then. And all of them lined up on each other. And what became a combined gas law or general gas law now was a universal gas law. And boom. And then the latecomer was Poincaré. Poincaré proves his recurrence theorem in 1890, and in a popular article comments that it contradicts what Boltzmann had done. But the criticism of that criticism came right away, but your paper only proved it in three dimensions. Remember, they didn't use vectors back then. So Poincaré's article has three space dimensions. Zermelo redoes Poincaré's proof with a lot of dot, dot, dots. Also not using vectors yet. And then more seriously critiques. Boltzmann responds, there were actually two back and forth, and basically says, you should live so long to see the recurrence time. But, you know, very interesting. All right, so Hilbert called for mathematicians to think this was the sixth problem. So I'm going very quickly now. There are two parts to it. Notice two words I want you to see here. One is axioms, axiomatic. That was top of Hilbert's mind because it was very much at a revolution in mathematics that was ongoing at the time. And limiting analysis, right? Probability, connecting to statistical physics, and connecting to continuum mechanics. All right, I just mentioned very briefly here that this was really, the axiomatic approach was already ongoing in mathematics and would continue to ongo. Probability theory was just born, at least for stochastic processes. Here's Bachelet, happily mentioning him here. There's some finance people in the audience that knows about this. And then we have a whole bunch of people to varying degrees embracing this. Einstein's theories are presented to the physicist in axiomatic form. Ergodic theory was developed by Birkhoff, von Neumann, Hopf. Hopf was mentioned earlier in this context exactly, and Fomin and Gelfand, for example. I've left off many names. And then you had the new statistical physics of Gibbs, the quantum physics revolution, and relativity by Einstein, all of which, to varying degrees, adopted more of an axiomatic approach. Okay. This makes it clear that the sixth problem of Hilbert really is not one problem, but rather providing an endless supply of problems to be solved. And it's not going to end with any one paper. And the one point I want to make is it's about much more than classical hard spheres and periodic domains. But I'm not saying that that kind of problem isn't a great place to start. But it's only a start. And the best any of us can claim to have is to make a contribution which actually points the way for others to make contributions, because this is not an ending process. And by this measure, the opus of Claude has been remarkable when we see all of us he's influenced with his work on the sixth problem, related to the sixth problem. Okay, now I'm out of time, so I just want to say one thing. There are, even within BGL, there's things to do. Here's a fluid system Claude and I worked on for a number of years. This is actually a rigorous, this is an asymptotic limit, formal. We can't prove this from de Bernoullis. Notice that the heat equation has viscous heating in it, but it also has this time derivative pressure. I've not even seen for this theory good math worked out except for classical solutions. So the Nolle-Ray analog. There's others like weakly compressible models that go back to the mid 80s at least. And our best results for the full Euler and Navier-Stokes systems are really tied by limitations for our theories for those systems and limitations on the theories for the Boltzmann equation. Progress on either of these will advance this. I'm not going to drag you through this, except to say that what I'm giving you here is a way to get, with that magic recipe here, a system, an approximation to fluid dynamics, which goes on beyond the compressible Navier-Stokes approximation. This is entropy respecting and everything like that. So this, even for classical solutions, this needs work. And another one related to it has recently been posted by Michael, who's here in the audience, right? And Arana, who was part of the program up until recently, Tom Hughes, and Baidu, who I don't know. anyway, and these are related to known systems. Happy birthday, Claude, and thank you all for putting up with me running a little over.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.